Hey there, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. The international rules-based order, the rules-based system, the international order. We have all heard these names or variations of them at some point. Used to describe the existing balance of power, these terms mislead, implying that the nations who lead this supposed order are actually committed to any binding set of rules or principles, as opposed to Anglo-American imperialism and military might. Yet we are being told on a regular basis that, in the West at least, that this rules-based order is under threat. The only alternative to this Western imperialism-based system, we are being told, is the emerging multipolar world order, an order to be based on cooperation, trade, and respect for national sovereignty and led by Eurasia, with that meaning chiefly Russia and China. The Ukraine crisis, which appears to be a war waged just as much on social media as on the ground, is the latest event that urges us to pick a side and pick one of these two orders. Will we side with the international rules-based order led by the Anglo-American Empire, or will we side with the Russia and China-led multipolar world order? As my guests and I will be discussing today, both of these options are really ruses, as both sides are steadily marching towards the imposition of a tyrannical technocracy, a trend that accelerated on both sides during COVID-19, and a trend that is due to continue accelerating even further under the threat of a regional and perhaps even global war. Joining me today to pick apart the propaganda regarding global governance with a focus on current events in Ukraine is Ian Davis. Ian is an independent investigative journalist, blogger, and author from Portsmouth in the UK, and is a contributor to UK Column and Unlimited Hangout. His work is often featured by Off Guardian, The Corbett Report, and Zero Hedge, among others, and he also has his own excellent website called In This Together, which you can find at in-this-together.com. Thanks for joining me today, Ian. How's it going?
I'm very well, thank you, Whitney, and thanks very much for having me. How are you?
I am doing about as well as you would expect. The world is more insane every day,
it is.
And I'm feeling that for sure, and also being a new mom at the same time as watching the world being perpetually on fire. It's interesting. Anyway, let's not talk about that anymore. Instead, I do want to get into the Ukraine crisis later on, because since that, of course, is the topic of the hour. But before we do that, let's go over some of the ideas and facts you cover in your recent article for Unlimited Hangout entitled Technocracy, the Operating System for the New International Rules-Based Order. Could you first off explain what the international rules-based order is, both in terms of how it publicly presents itself, as well as in terms of what it actually is in practice?
The internet, one of the first things that is difficult to establish with the international rules-based order is precisely what it is, because depending on the language used at the time, the definition of it has tended to change throughout history. But certainly in the post-World War II period, it has been what we might call a unipolar world war, international rules-based system. And I think it was the Council on Foreign Relations, Patrick Stewart from the Council of Foreign Relations in 2016. He described it as, and there's a quote here that's from the article, "What sets the post-1945 Western order apart is that it was shaped overwhelmingly by a single power, the United States, operating within a broader context of strategic bipolarity. It constructed, managed, and defended the regimes of the capitalist world economy." So what he is describing is what we could perhaps call a Western hegemony, and that has kind of set the rules. And I think The important thing here, and one of the reasons why I think they often talk about the rules-based order, is that it isn't necessarily based on international law. International law is a component of it and is often cited as reasons for taking action. But it is really about more than just international law. It's about setting standards of behavior, and obviously these standards in the current, what we can call for brevity's sake, the IRBO, international rules based order, set by the western led powers, and it's about the rules that they decree are required for trade, for international relations, acceptable behaviour by nation states. And they claim that this is based upon their values, and you know, we might go on to talk about how kind of how much they actually adhere to those values being freedom of speech, democracy, equality, those kind of things. So that's what the international rules based order is presented as to us, that it's this. There's a moral component to it, and that there's some kind of claim of moral superiority attached to it. And Western nations, and we see that all the time. We're seeing it at the moment in regards to the conversation about the Ukraine, that you know that it's an attack on democracy, and an attack on one democracy is an attack on all democracies. And it's this use of this sense of kind of moral superiority, especially around democracy and democratic principles, that is often used to berate the people who we might call, you know, the nations that perhaps we might see on the opposing side of that spectrum, you know, which traditionally, you know, we might be talking about Russia, China, Iran, countries like that. But very recently, prior to the events that are happening now, on the 4th of February, Xi Jinping and Putin announced their model. And this is a very a different model, which interestingly, and I think one of the key things that, they said in their statement, they made a joint statement on what the new international law-based system might be. So this would be, they actually called it the international law-based world order. So they're shifting the narrative in their in the new model, in the new kind of what we might call a Eurasian kind of centric model, with China and Russia very much in partnership in that that new suggested world order. They're focusing on the law-based aspect. So that is a direct attack upon the what we might call the existing, but even the Council on Foreign Relations admit a fading Western hegemony, and something else that the World Economic Forum have openly discussed as well, about the fact that the balance of power is shifting eastwards.
Right.
So this is a very it's a different concept. It's a multipolar concept. They're talking more about equality between nations, but again, I think we need to take that with a pinch of salt. And it's the stressing of this law-based element.
Well, I just think it's interesting that, you know, the IRBO is, as you call it, is Western based. It's about Western hegemony. But some of the, you know, I guess think tanks of the Western elite, some of the ones you've named already have essentially been making a sales pitch more or less for this this multipolar world order, you know, led by Russia and China. For a while now, from what it seems to me, as basically saying that we need to move away from the Western hegemony model, even though they ostensibly benefit and helped create that model, or at least help maintain it, depending on when these institutions were made, and that they've sort of been saying this is where it's inevitable that things move this way. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, more to the point, it's I think we can replace multipolar with multi-stakeholder. Because
I would agree. What do you mean by that, though, for people that may not understand the move there?
Well, the idea is that's been presented by China and Russia is that the nation state based on a system of law very much controlled by, and there's something else that that both Putin and Xi Jinping repeatedly stress is the importance of the United Nations as a center for administering international law.
Yeah.
So their argument is that nation states should all be treated equally. So you would have this multipolar system with no one individual group or no block, and this is something else that they repeatedly said in their statement about challenging the idea of blocks of nations, although ironically that is exactly what they are forming. But the idea is that everybody is equal in this system of multipolarity. That is the way that the multi-stakeholder system of stakeholder capitalism is sold. That's the way that that's sold, that everybody, it's a relationship of equal partners. Well, that's exactly what they are talking about in terms of international relations between nation states. But as we already know, those nation states are partners with multinational corporations, none more so than Russia and China, who's, you know, the Western, so not just Western corporations, all global corporations have significant investments in both of those countries, and they partner with them on a great many things, particularly in Russia's case around the regulation of information and ICT kind of information and communication technology, which again, in their statement, in their joint statement, they repeatedly referenced about this idea. And one thing that Klaus Schwab has said is that he feels that Russia are a leading voice on international ICT regulation. So as we move into the fourth industrial revolution, which obviously been, you know, the idea that the Internet of Things and the Internet of People, global governance of that, which again is something that comes up in their joint statement about global governance of international information and communication technology, as far as the we know from the World Economic Forum, Russia are one of the leading voices in that regulation. So, and Russia have got a particularly close relationship with the World Economic Forum. There's some debate about how close Putin and Schwab are, but certainly Putin refers to Schwab as, you know, as dear Klaus. They knew each other well in St. Petersburg, it seems, through the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which is a partner economic forum to the World Economic Forum. And during the 1990s, when Putin was a rising politician in St. Petersburg, one of the reasons that he came to prominence was that his seemingly amazing ability to attract international investment into St. Petersburg and into Russia. Well, at that time, it's also, he's openly stated in some of his comments when he spoke at the World Economic Forum Davos meeting, that he met Klaus many times in that period in St. Petersburg, or was familiar certainly with the World Economic Forum. Russia are also, through their one of their state-owned banks, Sberbank, a subsidiary of Sberbank called Bizone, are the financial institution that run the scenarios, or set the scenarios and orchestrate the World Economic Forum's Cyber Polygon exercises, which are their annual cybersecurity exercises.
Well, I believe Bizone is actually a cybersecurity company. They're a subsidiary of Sberbank, and Sberbank is currently trying to be a, not just a bank, but a universe of services, as they describe it. And so this is their cybersecurity service that co-hosts that with the World Economic Forum. But you're right that that there is a major emphasis on financial institutions, specifically banks, with Cyber Polygon, and a lot of those, as you point out in your article, actually are Russian, I believe.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of the kind of a slightly amusing, perhaps, With the stories that we get in the Western media about the threat that Russian banks and the threat that Russian hackers and so forth present to the West, and we've had all these claims in the media about Russia threatening a cybersecurity threat to the West, and yet major Western corporations, such as Deutsche Bank and Santander and so forth, they're involved in Cyber Polygon
Right. You even have
alongside.
people like Tony Blair giving major panel talks at Cyber Polygon and international security experts from the US that used to work in cybersecurity, for example, in the Obama administration and in the US and also in Europe, basically coming together despite so somehow, the whole Russian hacker narrative doesn't apply in the context of Cyber Polygon. It only applies to mainstream media stories directed at the public, but when they're all together, it essentially disappears, which tells you a lot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it's I mean, you would have think if this was a genuine risk, then Cyber Polygon specifically, given who orchestrates it and runs it and sets the
Right.
scenarios and is involved, would be, a considerable security risk. You wouldn't imagine that any if what we are given to believe is supposed to be true, that any Western corporations would go and touch it with a barge pole. But and yet the opposite is true. That because of, within that they're working in partnership. I mean, Cyber Polygon itself is it openly states this is about building partnerships on information and communication technology security, internet security.
Right.
So it's hard therefore, to look at these stories that we get and give them any credence, really.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Some things I will add, and for people that are interested more in ties between Russia and the World Economic Forum, I would refer you to the recent podcast I did with Riley Wagaman, specifically about the Russia and the World Economic Forum and the Sputnik V vaccine. Because Sberbank, which you were just talking about, Ian, it turns out that the CEO of that, Herman Greff or Graf, depending. If you're going to use the, I guess, Russian version or the German version of his last name, is on, I believe, on the board of trustees of the World Economic Forum. And Sberbank was actually responsible for major parts of the development and distribution of the Sputnik V vaccine, which is pretty interesting that you would entrust the distribution of the COVID-19 vaccine to a bank. Seems a little odd, but Seattle or the state of Washington used Starbucks to help in distribution over there. So I guess it's not that weird in that context, but it definitely should raise a few eyebrows. And I think that's one thing we can see here in what we're talking about in terms of these two supposedly opposing sides, because with the the IRBO, the Western hegemony order in the states that lead that, and the states that are supposed to be leading this push into the multipolar world or the multi-stakeholder world, as you call it, they essentially enacted the same COVID policy. And it's not hard to argue that some of those policies were in violation of the international laws that Russia and China seem to be promoting as part of this world order as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean they're absolutely, using the phrase they're in lockstep, aren't they, with globally on in terms of, and that's again is something that came up in their joint statement that they felt that it was important to. I think one of the things that they said in their statement was that how important it was to maintain the recovery, the economic recovery following the COVID crisis, and that they saw this as ongoing, and that in terms of Russia and China working together, the things that they stressed of great importance was the international fight against epidemics, world economic recovery, inclusive and sustainable development, improving the global economic governance system. So this is
Hmm.
precisely the same. I mean, it's exactly the same rhetoric, and it's exactly the same objectives couched in slightly different terms than we see from the Western international rules-based order system. It's the same. It's indivisible. The only difference is who is claiming to have primacy in that delivering of that system. But it's the
Right.
same system. There's no
Oh,
difference.
goody.
Well, exactly. It's, I mean, the you could this their joint statement could have been said by, could, well, not Biden, but I mean, it could have
Any
been,
number of countries,
yeah, it
yeah.
could have been said by anybody. I mean, it's the same rhetoric.
Well, what's interesting in the context of that statement is since it was made not that long ago, there's been quite a bit of buzz, not as much of not as much as the Ukraine crisis has caused, but people have been pointing out that the World Health Organization is moving to update its pandemic treaty, and quite a power grab, for lack of a better term for it, from what I understand, and I haven't really read the nuts and bolts of it myself, but it would essentially give the World Health Organization and by the United Nations essentially primacy over national governments in terms of determining pandemic response. And so that's interesting that crops up in the joint statement. And the second thing, economic recovery. I think in the case of Russia and China, a lot of that quote unquote economic recovery is fourth industrial revolutions based. And I think that's the whole economic system that they're essentially moving towards. And over the course of COVID-19, since it began, Russia and China have made leaps and bounds in that regard, and also in terms of requiring QR codes. Arguably, China more extensive than Russia, but in Russia, it's been quite considerable, from what I understand.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of, I mean, one of the things that stood out for me in that statement was they were talking about the digitalization of a wide range of different spheres of life, which is
Oh,
which is
who benefits from that?
yeah, which is fourth. It's just pure fourth industrial revolution. This is where we're going. There's no difference. And they're also, I think one of the things that's kind of important that they're trying to get across in their new model is that they are pinning everything on the United Nations and large global intergovernmental institutions, which would include, for example, the World Health Organization. So they want to be take primacy within this system, this law-based system based on things like World Health Organization treaties, which would see, I mean, unlike you, I haven't read the details of that, but as I understand it as well, in the event of a epidemic or crisis, centralized global governance would kick in and give them decision-making abilities over and above nation states, which is pretty much what we've been talking about in terms of, or what the both sides, both East and West, have been trying to create for generations. This
Right.
idea of centralized global governance.
This seems sort of like what happened with the Trans Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Originally, that was going to have a clause that essentially created these offshore courts that would allow, in practice, corporations to essentially remake laws of different countries, like those offshore courts where these the corporations could have sued state governments if a law infringed on their profits or potential future profits, right? So, and so this is sort of the UN way of getting around national governments and sort of creating some sort of body that allows them to supersede those national governments. But of course, they frame themselves as sort of a different type of organization than a multinational corporation. But as you've noted in your work and others have noted as well, the UN essentially functions like a public-private partnership, That's really what it is. And the World Health Organization within that is also that as well.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about there are the various dispute resolution mechanisms that they have in these deals. And they're always the same. I mean, you could look at the
right.
You know, TPP or CETA or whatever. You look at these dispute resolution mechanisms, and what they basically say is, if a nation state does something which adversely impacts the profit of a multinational corporation, that's illegal. You know, that's what they normally boil down to. So that is corporate, and I mean, and I think of, you know, a big part of what we're seeing, which, you know, something that I discussed in the article is if you fuse the state with the with corporations, it is not unreasonable to call that fascism. That is, you know, partly correct. The definition of fascism. And that's, you know, the state ceases to become solely a political entity in terms of its relationship with the populace. It then becomes a fusion between political, economic, financial institutions. So you don't vote for financial institutions, but they are very much involved in the decision-making process. And that's what this globally, and I think this is the important thing, as we're, you know, going on to discuss more current events in the Ukraine, there's no difference between either side in terms of their global aspirations. And I think I'm not saying that there aren't genuine, in my opinion, you know, there's genuine enmity there, that there are differences in ambition and differences about who is going to control this system, because the system is global and it's coming. And I think a lot of this kind of standoff between the powers, which is in this case has boiled over into a military confrontation, a military conflict, is about jockeying for position and primacy within that system. But the system doesn't change. The system we're getting is the one we're going to get unless we do something about it. And it's just about kind of jockeying for position within that new world order. And that's what's happening, in my view.
So in your article, you basically call this coming system that you were just talking about, label it as technocracy. And you spend a good bit of time in the article explaining the background of that and what it means, and how China has essentially been a testing ground in a lot of ways for that system. I think a lot of people have heard the term technocracy more and more lately, especially, but there's definitely a decent amount of people who never heard that term, before, you know, 2 years ago or even more recently. So I think it would be helpful to sort of give a brief overview of that, and then we'll turn to Ukraine.
Yeah, so technocracy is an idea that arose during the kind of progressive era in the US in the sort of 1910, 1920, that kind of time. And it ended up with there was an organization which brought together a guy called Howard Scott and M. King Hubbert, who is perhaps famous for his peak oil theory. And they created something called Technocracy Inc. And then they released a document in which was kind of the blueprint for what they were calling a North American technate. So, a technocracy in terms, if when it comes into being, in terms of a nation state, would be called the technate. And the idea was, it was very much about managing, because one of the key focus during the progressive era in the United States at that time was concerns about the use of resources. Everyone was very much concerned about excessive use of resources, running out of oil, running out of coal, running out of gas, and so forth. So the idea was that you would centrally manage the allocation of resources. So they wanted to create a system, and this is what technocracy is about, create a system that would enable the management of society. So this is central planning, So it's got some elements of what people might call kind of the socialist, communist kind of view in terms of economic central planning. It's got that. But it's also got within it kind of elements of the kind of capitalist system as well. Whereas, you know, corporations and companies would be able to make investments and to profit. You know, profit is not a dirty word in technocracy, but within the parameters set by the Central Planning Committee, who were technocrats. So the people at the center of it would be called technocrats. And the idea was that these people are the experts. So we're talking about scientists, engineers, mathematicians, economists, that they are the experts and therefore they should be appointed to make the decisions. They are the technocrats. And really the role of government within that was simply to administer the decisions of the technocrats. So that's that was the idea. Now, at the time, what this meant was that it was technologically impossible because they were talking about issuing a new form of currency in terms of energy certificates, which would all this data. So everybody, every time you spend one of your energy certificates, what you buy, where you buy, how much energy you use, all this would be collated and put together and would be fed back to the central planners, the technocrats. And that they would then make decisions about the overall allocation of resources on a technate-wide, and they were talking about the whole of the North American subcontinent, technate-wide system. Well, that was technologically impossible at the time, and people rightly went off the idea because they thought it was silly, and it was, you know, for that period. However, a group of people, notably the Rockefellers, John D. Rockefeller, saw the potential for this to work and because it was dependent upon the development of technology. So if they recognised that if technology ever caught up, then a technate would be possible. Later in the 1970s, Zbigniew Brzezinski, he wrote about in a Technotronic Era, but I can't remember the name of the book now, escapes me. He wrote about that. He didn't use the word technocracy, but he basically described a technate and what that would look like. Then Brzezinski, he goes off with David Rockefeller, and they end up forming the Trilateral Commission, who openly state that their objective is to introduce a system of global governance and talk about how they want to support China to develop, which at the time made sense because obviously China was an emerging market and a massive one. So, and they wanted to, you know, from a political perspective, put in a wedge between China and the Soviet. Then the Soviet Union made sense from a geopolitical perspective, and also accessing the market made sense from a economic perspective. However, what then followed was a period of 30 years, 40 years of exceptional foreign, what they call foreign direct investment into China from Western corporations, banks, and a liberalisation of the economic and financial relationship between East and West. And this facilitated the creation in China of what we can say, and we can genuinely say it's a technate, because technocracy is not viewed in China as being a bad idea, certainly not by the ruling elite. It is considered to be a good idea. And so that's fine if you've got a kind of feudal system, which, you know, if you look at Chinese history, it's very much up until kind of recent history has been based on kind of various forms of feudalism. Now, feudalism has got its plus points as well. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that feudalism was all bad. It has worked throughout history in certain places, but nonetheless, from a democratic perspective, it is the antithesis of democracy. So that's basically the system that has been created in modern day China in terms of allowing some economic liberalism and allowing that to flourish. Attracting investment, certainly into high tech and into information technology and so forth, attracting that, allowing that to flourish, but at the same time, being very, very focused on the control of resources. And also that means, by extension, that means the control of the population. And that comes down to the social credit system that they've got in China, which is it being increasingly used. It's not all pervasive, it's not everywhere. There are lots of places in China it hasn't reached yet, but roughly it's reached about 80% of the provinces in China. And it is more prevalent in the cities where they've got the facial recognition infrastructure and the communication technology to enable it to work. And it means that you are rewarded or punished for your, as a, from an individual's perspective, from a citizen's of the technate's perspective, you are rewarded or you are punished for your behavior. So as long as you toe the line, you're okay. But if you question the state or if you do something which the state doesn't approve of, for example, information smuggling. So that has become a crime in China. It's you're bringing in illegal information. So that kind of we're talking about that level of state control right down to the individual level. And another aspect of it, probably the primary aspect of it, is the social credit system for corporations, the corporate social credit system. Again, this has got the purpose of this is to control the activities of the businesses that are operating in China. Now, in the joint statement that Xi Jinping and Putin made, they are fully on board with the new global system of sustainable development. They think this is very important. And they are pushing the Green New Deal, but from their perspective, they are pushing that system. Now, to the extent of which, to the extent that when Erkki Liikanen from the IFRS at COP26 announced the International Sustainability Standards Board, which is an accountancy system to control the activity of business and investors, which is almost exactly the same as the social corporate social credit system in China, to the extent that when he announced that, China offered to host it. So this is, as we were talking about earlier, when we spoke about it being one system, the system that is being rolled out globally is modelled upon the system that has been, and I strongly argue, has been the test bed for that system has been in China over the last 40 or 50 years, and it has brought a remarkable turnaround in China's economic fortunes and its technological capability. So that has certainly happened, and the population has certainly benefited from that. However, as an already developed economy, there isn't much that we're going to benefit from that. The benefit is not there for Western.
Well, for the individual, but I think for corporations it's different. And sort of if you look at, GFANZ, which I've written about, and some of these other sustainable development banking initiatives led by people like Mark Carney, and people like that, they essentially say, if you join us or, you know, do this whole ESG system, you know, you can become, you know, very successful if you play by these new rules. But if you don't adapt to the new system being imposed by both sides, you know, the West and the East and everywhere in between, then you won't survive. But if you choose to play by our rules, you'll benefit greatly. That's sort of the sales pitch there, more or less, to corporations. And it seems like that there will be plenty of takers in the corporate world, even if in the, you know, on the individual level, it won't necessarily improve the circumstances of people in the West. I don't think that's necessarily true for the corporate world.
No. If you partner with government, then it's game on in the corporate world.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that,
fascism.
Yeah, exactly. Fascism. And that has the added advantage of, as you know, the role of government, which the United Nations have spoke about, and the World Economic Forum, and even people like the World Health Organization, is about creating the enabling environment, which they will achieve through taxing us. So we'll be taxed to create markets which government partners, who will be the selected corporations. So, you know, one capitalist kills many, and this is that in extremis, will absolutely be raking it in from us. So,
right.
But unfortunately, what that means is for smaller, I mean, it isn't really clear yet to the cost of adapting to, because every in the UK, they've already got to the point where they've got a commitment that by 2025, all business will be submitting its sustainability standards report to the ISSB. Now, they've piloted it to start with 300 of the FTSE 500 top companies, you know, so it's the big players are the people that are starting with that system. But their intention is to extend it to all business. So, I mean, the cost implications of that to small to medium sized enterprises is probably beyond their reach. So they go out of business, leaving cheap assets lying around in the market. And who's going to get them? You know, the people who are partners with government. If you're partners with government, it's going to be a gravy train bonanza.
Well, you know, this is even more extreme given what happened with COVID-19 and the lockdowns and the effect that already had on small to medium sized businesses. So this will just be an even bigger opportunity, I guess you could say, for, you know, big corporations to sort of whittle down the remaining small and medium sized businesses in different countries. Very unfortunate, to say the least. Well, so talking about China, as you say, the test bed for this, I'm sure you've heard that. Well, this is really common more on the political right of alternative media. They tend to see China and the CCP sort of as the, I guess you could say, the mastermind for a lot of what's going on right now. There's a lot of, implications that the digital ID agenda is coming out of China, and that organizations like the World Economic Forum are doing China's bidding. I'm sure you've come across these claims before, but they've gotten a lot more traction recently, for example, being put out pretty regularly on the Joe Rogan podcast, the Joe Rogan Experience podcast, which is like the biggest podcast in the United States. So it definitely is reaching a lot of people. So what do you say to people that make that claim?
I mean, as I was saying earlier, I think, you know, nation states and certainly China are, you know, the Central Communist Party Committee have an agenda of their own, you know, and they want a bigger slice of the pie for themselves and for their oligarch friends. And that, I think the situation is exactly the same in Russia, and the situation is exactly the same in Germany and France and the US and everywhere else. Everyone is vying for a slice of the pie. But to those people that say China are leading on this system, if you look at the statements of the Western international rules-based order clique, if you look at their commitment to sustainable development goals, their commitment to restructuring the international financial system, it's the same. It's the same commitment. It's not a different commitment. So if China are leading on it, as some people claim, well, then the West are following China. But then, or are the Chinese following the West? Because, it's the same system, but dressed up with a different sales pitch, depending on the audience that is listening to it. But it's the same system. And that system has not developed in China in the last 70 years. It has developed globally in the last 100 years. So this is the globalization of an entire economic, financial, and monetary system. It's not, and nation states, in my opinion, are vying for their seat at the table within that system.
Fair enough. What I would add to that is this system emerging in China, I mean, I think it's hard to blame it all on the CCP, as some people have done, because, as you mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of influence of Western capital and forces like the Rockefellers, who are very open about their historic, by historic, I mean several decades back, relationship with the Chinese government. You also have people like Henry Kissinger and the opening up of China, and, sort of these cozy business relationships that were developing that helped bring about the rise of China to a significant degree. So you can't really view it as something CCP exclusive, because sort of inherent in that narrative is the idea that, oh, if we could defeat the CCP, then we could stop technocracy. And I don't think that's true at all. It's really a hydra, not a one-headed snake. You're looking at something that has, if you stop one political party implementing it in one country, you're not going to stop the rollout of a global technocratic system.
No, absolutely. And I think that's, you said something very important there. I mean, the flow of capital from West to East to enable this system to be put into operation first in China, that's been done willingly. I mean, there are so many decisions that were made, certainly by the US administration, that went a long way towards facilitating the growth of that that burgeoning technocracy in China. So it's not as if the West have been opposed to that. They've enabled it through, such things as, allowing China to import what the quote unquote sensitive technology, enabling lifting embargoes that enable. So you could put your hard-nosed economic view to that and say, well, that is simply enabling the growth of a foreign market for your own benefit, which is true. Then there is an economic benefit to enable flourishing export markets, of course there is, but it's also doing so knowing that you are creating what in the future is going to be and is rapidly becoming a major leading world superpower, knowing that you're doing that to challenge the unipolar world order that you supposedly believe in. So throughout, people like Kissinger and so forth that are espousing the idea of the international rules-based order and latterly people like Obama and so forth and the Clintons, that rattle on about this idea of the kind of Western hegemony IRBO that's based on democratic principles and so forth have been consistently throughout over the last many decades making policy decisions and making economic decisions which enable the growth of a superpower and an opposing superpower. Now, they didn't do that unwittingly. They knew what, you know, at some level, people were sure, certainly people like Kissinger would have been well aware of that.
Well, in the last 20 to 30 minutes or so, I'd really like to turn to Ukraine now, since there's so much going on over there. So I do want to specify that we are recording this on Tuesday, March 1st. So by the time this comes out, things may have changed. It's a rapidly developing and evolving situation. So essentially what we have in the Ukraine crisis is these two orders that you've discussed, the IRBO and the Russia-China camp, their multipolar axis, opposing each other in Ukraine, more or less. So of course, we have the official narrative, the prevailing narrative and alternative media. The question is there a third narrative? Is there something else going on? I don't know if you'd like to start giving a brief overview of the sort of, I guess, 2D narrative, as James Corbett recently called it, or if you'd just like to say what, just give your thoughts on the matter. Either's fine with me.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I mean, I'm not even sure it's happening. I mean, I don't.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there is a significant lack of reporting on the ground. I mean, from what I've seen, actually, I need to point this out. I've seen nothing today. I've been out and about today, so I don't know what's happened today. But you know, I mean, if we compare it to say the, you know, what happened in 2003 with the Iraq War, or what happened in Syria or Libya, you know, there was plenty of footage of, you know, some of the confrontations and skirmishes that were happening. There doesn't seem to be much of that, not that I've seen anyway. So I do have to question how extensive this quote unquote invasion is supposed to be or is. I mean, I've got no doubt that obviously, you know, Russia seemed to have certainly made it to the last I saw. They'd made it to Kharkov and they were secure in the Donbass region in the east of the Ukraine. And they've obviously struck military targets in Ukraine, wider Ukraine. But I don't see them. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Perhaps you could tell me what's happened today. But I don't see much evidence of them marching on Kiev or anything like that. But, you know, perhaps they have today. I don't know.
Well, supposedly there's photos out, though I haven't personally seen them, of Russian troops around Kiev that are looking to move in. Like I said, I haven't looked at it personally, and I have had a pretty busy day today, so I haven't been following the latest updates. But I will point out, regarding what you said, I am pretty surprised by the extreme amount of basically fake battle footage that has been circulating on social media. I mean, it just seems like almost everything that circulates is fake. And you know, this has gone on in Syria. There's been, you know, when that over the years of that conflict, there have been, you know, fakes like that too, where people used video game footage or used a picture from Gaza and said it was Syria or something like that, you know, and that's happening now too. But it just seems like all the percentage of footage claiming to be from this conflict that is false in that way is just much higher than it's been in other conflicts. And it almost seems like this is a war that is using social media as a major theater. I sort of alluded to that in the introduction, because it's just seems to be very, very much based around Twitter and Facebook and these viral videos that later on, you know, have turned out, there's multiple examples, if you look for them, have turned out not to be what they say they are. Even recent pictures showing or pictures that have been on multiple news outlets talking about the current crisis, showing the Ukrainian president Zelensky in military equipment, wearing military equipment and a helmet and all of this. This is has been shown to be from last year, a tour of the border, but he was dressed like that. It's not from the current hostilities. It's just it all seems very odd. But one effect I will say that this is having, this focus on social media, you know, it there's a lot of focus on convincing the English speaking world that the fight in Ukraine is just, that there can be implying that they just need a little bit of support and this will be a quick war and they can easily defend themselves. It sort of seems like a way to manufacture consent among the West for NATO countries to essentially escalate in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that stands in kind of, I've seen those media reports as well myself, but that does kind of stand in a contrast to what the politicians have been saying. Because certainly in the UK, Boris Johnson has multiple times goes on about a protracted crisis. You know, he's used that phrase quite a few times, talking about a protracted struggle. Almost as if they are kind of looking forward to bogging some sort of the Russian military down in another kind of guerrilla warfare, you know, and there's, you know, the response in terms of, you know, even prior to the actions that Russia took. And I have to say, I do have some sympathy with those who say that Russia, in this instance, Russia have got a good case. I would say there is never a good case for killing people. I personally draw a just flat out no. There's never a good case for killing people. And anybody that argues that there is, I think, needs to rethink their worldview, in my opinion. And I don't support what Russia are doing because they're killing people. But then I think you also need to see it in relative terms, because such is the nature of government. That's what governments do. Governments, when push comes to shove, will kill people. And that's what they certainly, the US and the Western international rules-based order, despite all its pretensions of democratic wonder and accountability and, you know, I mean, it's, you know, how many millions of people have they killed? They killed 3 million people just in Vietnam. I mean, that's the nature of government. And I personally have my own problems with that, but that's regardless. But nonetheless, so if you look at it in relative terms, I do have some kind of sympathy for those that say that there is some justification for Russia in this case. And there's undoubtedly been an impact in the Ukraine from the far right. The far right has been prominent, but not dominant. And I think this is the important thing. A lot of people seem to be casting the Ukraine as some sort of fascist, you know, on one side of the argument, the kind of pro-Putin side of the argument. Seems to be people sort of casting the Ukraine as some sort of fascist country. It isn't. It's if you look at its electoral history, both in the northern and western oblasts, it's, and obviously in the southern and eastern oblasts, it's voted broadly socialist, not national socialist, socialist. And that's broadly been its electoral history and its short lifespan. So it's not a fascist country. And the idea that it is run by fascists, I think is going too far. However, the far right, who seized disproportionate political and military power as a consequence of the Euromaidan coup, and I think it was undoubtedly a coup. Yanukovych was an elected leader who was still in office, so that's a coup. I mean, you can't say that it wasn't. It was. So they seized that moment with the backing, undoubtedly, of the West. and prominent politicians like Newland and McCain and people like that certainly enabled or exploited the far right in Ukraine to create what was a coup. And because of that support, they were only, I think, Svoboda, who was the political party of associated. They're not the right sector, but certainly affiliated to the right sector. The Svoboda got, I think, they got 37 or 38 seats in the 2012 parliamentary elections. Or was that the president parliamentary election? So they got, that made them about the fourth largest party in the Ukraine, but way below the leading party. I mean, I think the Party of Regions, I think it was, they had 185 seats. So that gives you some sort of idea of a kind of comparison. And Svoboda only had 37. But nonetheless, it is true to say that certainly in the northern and the further north and the further west you go, there is some popular support for outright, absolutely outright neo-Nazis. And they are neo-Nazis. They want to see a united Ukraine. These ultras want to see a united Ukraine, and they want to see Russians, Jews and Poles exterminated. There's no doubt that that's what they, that what, how they envisage that. That's their worldview.
I mean, some of them are on video using that exact language, to be fair. So, yeah. Well, I think, you know, to sum up the situation more or less, you've done a pretty all right job, though it's been a while since I followed the Ukraine crisis. I wrote about it when I worked at Mint Press. So it's been a couple years because I left there at the beginning of 2020. But, you know, one challenge I would raise to what you brought up about Russia and how, you know, it's wrong that they're killing people. I guess the obviously people are dying. Yes. But I think the, you know, to be devil's advocate here, I think people would say that the Ukrainian government was killing people in the Donbass. I think they have a civilian death toll in, you know, above 10,000 in that conflict, which has gone on for about 8 years. And apparently that was escalating in the lead up to what's happening right now, which had led the leaders of those two, I guess they're calling themselves People's Republics, to go and request independent status from the Russian government, which sort of ended up setting off a lot of this. As I understand it. But beyond that, I would definitely agree that 2014 was a coup. And following that coup, these far-right elements at least became more prominent. How much more prominent, I think, is something that perhaps could be debated. But I think it's you can't really say that those forces don't exist in Ukraine, and they do have influence. I think it's not as I don't think it's necessarily fair to paint all of Ukraine's politicians and the entire Ukrainian post-coup state as necessarily all neo-Nazi. I don't think that's I think that's probably extreme. but I have seen some people do that, but I think that tends to happen when there's conflicts. You know, people tend to polarize, and, you know, I mean, there's the people saying Putin is literally Hitler, and people saying Putin is really great for doing this. You know, I don't really plan to take a side, because as we've been talking about, these two sides here ultimately are embracing the same sort of system ultimately. So what we're having here is a, I guess you could call it sort of like a proxy conflict between the two camps we've spent most of the podcast talking about thus far.
And I think that, you know, definitely the you know, if you look at kind of, if you look at it from an international law perspective, the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic have ostensibly followed international law. They meet the criteria for an independent state. And it's their right to declare one if they wish. You know, I mean, you could look at it from that perspective.
Well, also the Minsk agreements, as I understand it, were going to allow them to have a referendum as to whether or not they wanted to be independent, and they were denied that right.
Yes.
By the government in Kiev, which has been shelling them instead for the better part of 7 years now. I mean, it is a sticky situation, but a lot of the people claiming to care about Ukrainians right now didn't care very much about the the Ukrainians living in those particular provinces for the past 7 years, which I would stress them to consider reading up about, you know, the conflict up to this point. And regarding what I said about the whole Ukrainian government not being it being unfair to characterize it all as Nazi, you know, as I understand it, the current president Zelensky, his campaign was about mending ties with Russia, or rather de-escalating the extreme anti-Russian sentiment expressed by some of these forces that became more prominent after the 2014 coup. And I mean, that shows that there was some sort of political will, at least at that time during that election, which I think was 2019, not that long ago, to improve the situation with Russia and to de-escalate the conflict in the Donbass.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Russia. So on the one hand, you've got a population that are kind of in the Donbass that are being shelled. The Minsk agreement, it was the Ukrainian. I mean, one of the things that Putin, I think, said, I can't remember when he said it, but one of the things he pointed out was that it didn't really matter what the Minsk agreement was, because he felt that the Ukrainian military and the National Guard, which contains these Azov battalions who are closely related to the right sector, who were instrumental in the Euromaidan shootings, in my opinion, they aren't under, you know, they're not under being controlled by you know, the Kiev central government. They've got a certain amount of, or seem to have a certain amount of autonomy. And I think Putin pointed that out and said, look, you know, we've made an agreement twice, because there was Minsk agreement in 2014 and again in 2015, where they did exactly as you said, guaranteed some of the sort of borders of the region and offered, hopefully at some point, for a referendum amongst the new republics to see whether they wanted to form an independent republic. That didn't happen because following the agreements, either at the behest of Kiev or, and I think that Putin might have had a point, independent elements within the Ukrainian military were carried on shelling the Donbass and shelling civilian populations. And so from that perspective, you know, Putin has got a right to say, you know, we're there to defend Russian speaking and further south actual ethnic Russians from attack by the elements, certainly within the Ukrainian forces. And to what extent Kiev controls them is, I think, questionable at times, but, you know, it's difficult to say. So there's that part of it, which, again, you would say, you know, that gives Putin some sort of legitimacy, I suppose you could say, in terms of the action that they've taken. However, I think the bigger picture that is far more pressing on probably, you know, the Russians' minds is the expansion of NATO.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which mm-hmm. which is really where they're drawing the line.
Well, I think a lot of the rhetoric out of Russia right now is emphasizing the Nazi angle, but I think ultimately, yeah, you know, this goes back to the NATO expansion issue.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. Well. I mean, obviously. I mean, you know, NATO. I mean, you can go back to I think it was 2008, and it was the Bucharest summit meeting in 2008, and clause 23 of that, and I'm quoting this, so this is going back to 2008, and obviously up to 2008, NATO, following the fall of the Soviet Union, or the disillusionment of the Soviet Union in 1991, NATO have been continually expanding eastwards. I mean, and taking many of those nations and there's no doubt that they, and I think this is another point which is true, that's kind of famous quote of not one inch eastward, which Secretary of State James Baker made to Gorbachev. It wasn't just that he said that. He did say that on numerous occasions. I think he said it three or four times. But there were formal agreements in place, quite a lot of formal agreements in place, that NATO wouldn't expand eastward. It then completely ignored those, ignored them completely. And in the 2008 Bucharest summit, Clause 23 reads, quote, NATO welcomes Ukraine's and Georgia's Euro-Atlantic aspirations for membership in NATO. We agreed today that these countries will become members of NATO. Now, from a Russian perspective, what does that mean? That means US forces and, more importantly, perhaps US missile capability right on their southern border. I suppose you could, for those that say that Putin and Russia haven't got a point, imagine what the situation would be if, well, think of the Suez Crisis, or imagine what the situation would be if Mexico had an agreement with China that China would site its missile silos on the Mexican-US border. I mean, what would be the US reaction to that? So,
Yeah, people have sort of pointed to this as an inversion, in a way, of the Cuban Missile Crisis during the Kennedy administration.
yeah, Cuban Missile Cross Suez, I was thinking.
All right. Well, we've talked a good bit about the 2D narrative, I guess you could say, to an extent. But you've pointed to a couple things that you think suggest that there may be something else at work here. One thing I do want to point out is, it seems like to me that this was sort of a baited war, at least from the Western end, because you had the Biden administration really upping the ante before this these hostilities ended up manifesting themselves. And if you believe the Russian side anyway, the decision per Putin was made to take this action, military action that's been taken, in large part because Zelensky of Ukraine went to the Munich Security Conference and implied that, well, pretty much said really, that Ukraine was going to be exploring how to become a nuclear power again. So obviously that's throwing considerable fuel on the fire, and I think it's quite clear that, given the complaints of Russia over the years about Ukraine and NATO expansion, specifically as it appears to relate to Ukraine, with Ukraine doing exercises with NATO and NATO infrastructure creeping into Ukraine. And I think the West, which influences Ukraine to a significant degree, especially after the 2014 coup, would have known that that would have been a red line for Putin, right? So you could argue that, at the very least, the West, and there's other examples as well of sort of these, escalations. You could argue sort of this prodding coming from the West to sort of try and goad Russia into taking some sort of action. I mean, I think you can make that case with what's going on right now. But the question is, are the people on the other side, mainly Russia here, sort of are they in on it? Right, I think some people have been asking that because of the common World Economic Forum ties between these sides and some of these, the commonality of this move towards technocracy, like we've been talking about today. So I'd like to hear your thoughts about if you think this is the case and why that would be, if so.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of maneuvering in preparation for this. You can look at, for example, in early February, China agreed to buy Russian grain, and that is a significant move because Russia is a grain exporter, particularly to the European Union. And it's never been able to export to. There's been a bit of protectionism going on there with China. Their argument that they didn't want Russian grain was because they said it was infested with weevils. But they've decided that they don't mind so much about that anymore, and they got an agreement with Russia, which was taken on the 8th or prior. So this is the 8th of February, before the military action started, but obviously was at the time when the US was saying there's going to be a war, there's going to be a war, there's going to be a war, which is an unusual. I found that quite unusual that the US were kept saying this is the date of the invasion, this is when the invasion's going to be, this is what Russia are going to do. And then Russia complied with that and did what the Western intelligence agencies were warning of. Anyway, but yeah, so China have got this agreement to buy grain. There's also when Xi Jinping and Putin made their joint statement about their new law-based world order, that was the same day that Putin announced a $117 billion investment or worth of Russian oil and gas deals with China, centering on the northward expansion of the Belt and Road project and what they're calling the Arctic Belt and Road, where they're opening up the Arctic for exploration. China are building the or heavily invested in constructing the infrastructure to enable this to get off the ground. In fact, I think China are actually building whole towns in the Arctic, in the Russian Arctic. Russia are building the biggest seaport in the world, and are investing billions in doing so. And obviously, I mean, this comes at a time when, in response to the actions that Russia have taken in the Ukraine, there's going to be the economic sanctions are being applied, which has already seen the ruble plummet. But the impact, equally, one of the first things that Scholz did in Germany when when this kicked off was to formally announce the formal cessation of any kind of idea of going forward with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia to Northern Europe, which would supply Northern Europe with well, cheaper gas, much cheaper gas than it.
Considerably cheaper from what I understand, yeah.
Yeah, much cheaper gas. So that's all come to an end. So then there's this talk about removing Russian banks, blocking their ability to borrow on the markets. Well,
And the SWIFT system
the
as well.
SWIFT system. Well, Russia's got its own alternatives already set up for, because all the SWIFT system is really is a communication system. It's not actually a financial system. It's just a way of trading. I mean, Russia's already got alternatives that it's set up for that, and so have China. So the net effect of this is to, in my view, is if this plays out, potentially how this could play out, is to throw Europe into a highly insecure. Certainly, its energy security could be threatened.
And
Its
food security to an extent.
food security could be threatened, which is going to exacerbate the inflation that we're already seeing. So it's not good for Europe. I mean, obviously, a war in Europe is not good for Europe, but I mean, in terms of the response from the West, is not good for Europe.
Yeah, it seems like the Western leaders aren't really thinking about these events, given their actions, but it seems like what you laid out that led up to this crisis in terms of economic deals between Russia and China, they were certainly, Russia was certainly preparing even more so than they have been in the past couple years to weather the worst possible sanctions the West could impose upon them. Is that what it, that's sort of what it seems like to me. But that's, you could argue also that that's sort of been a project several years in the making because these threats, like to eject Russia from SWIFT and other things, have been circulating for a while. This isn't a new threat. This is the first time, I guess, they've agreed to enact it. But it's definitely been discussed before, and I'm sure Russia is aware enough of it that they would move in that direction. But I think it's interesting that I think this is going to be used. Well, it's my opinion, but I think it's highly likely that Russia domestically is going to use this crisis as a way to advance its own sort of digital currencies, probably a CBDC of some sort. If not the digital ruble, you know, a spur bank that we talked about earlier has the spur coin or something like that. I think that's likely to see an increase in domestic use and circulation as the, you know, the ruble suffers because of the effect of Western sanctions, how that affects the international value of that currency. And things like that, I think it's going to be capitalized on in Russia domestically to advance some of this, you know, technocratic stuff we were sort of talking about earlier. And it's going to be justified as a way to work around sanctions. And at the same time, in Europe, you're going to have a big crunch in energy and in food. And what better way to get people to accept things they wouldn't normally accept, but under the fog of war and a hungry and cold population? You know, it seems sort of like a perfect storm in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, and I would, I wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. It looks like it's just another use of crisis. So it's the manufacturing of crisis. Well, manufacturing might be the wrong word. Obviously, you know, at times geopolitics falls out of balance. And, you know, you can definitely look at it from Russia's perspective and say that, you know, the expansion of NATO eastward has been ongoing for decades. And, you know, at what point do they, I mean, Putin and Lavrov openly said, didn't they, that NATO expansion into Ukraine was a red line. They repeatedly said that.
Yeah. So I think it's been known for years. They've been pretty clear about it. I mean, even one of my old reports I was looking at the other day, for Mint Press, back written in 2017, basically says that verbatim. So, I mean, this has been known for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the idea of constantly pushing. So one thing, I mean, you know, the rhetoric that is coming out of the Western political establishment is just insane. I mean,
Yeah, some of it is for sure.
Yeah. I mean, talking about, you know, our democratic, you know, how we... democratic institutions must be protected, and an attack on one democracy is an attack on all democracies. It's just not.
That sounds very much like NATO Article 5, though, doesn't that talking point to you?
Exactly.
And that's unsettling, because they've invoked Article 4, I think, for the first time, which is where they basically get together and talk about the possibility of invoking Article 5. You know, it's weird. I tend to think in terms of you know, potential foreknowledge or something like that, or you know, pre-planned efforts to sort of stoke this conflict and manifest it. It really seems to me that the West is doing it. Not to say that it's not possible that Russia may be in on it, right? But it just seems, I definitely have come to the conclusion from what I've been seeing that, you know, the CIA specifically seems to be stoking a lot of stuff. And part of the reason I say that is because there's the CFR's outlet, Foreign Affairs, was the first to essentially say that the CIA is likely already arming and training potential insurgents in Ukraine, specifically focusing on paramilitary groups, training them to kill Russians, including those that have the same sort of viewpoint, I guess you could say, as you know, these neo-Nazi groups like Azov Battalion, and that they've you know, they're pretty open that the CIA is planning an insurgency in Ukraine. I think just today, Hillary Clinton was on MSNBC saying, talking about the Ukraine crisis, bringing up the funding and financing of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which, if you're not familiar, that is the group that was funded by the CIA in Afghanistan to stop the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And that group eventually morphed into both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and is, you know, basically... you know, the whole blowback theory of 9/11 is based on that. But, you know, I would personally argue, because of my personal beliefs about 9/11, that, you know, those groups essentially remained assets of, you know, the where their funding originally came from, especially in the case of Al-Qaeda more so than the Taliban. And one thing I found really stunning, and if you're familiar with my work in 2020 about the coming war on domestic terror, this may be familiar to you. 2020 was the first year that the U.S. intelligence community did not issue their worldwide threat assessment. Instead, it was the first year that DHS, which has been around since like 2003, issued their domestic threat assessment, which I said at the time was a big shift away from the war on terror internationally to the war on domestic terror. A big signal of that from the intelligence community. And then there was this article published in Politico that I included in my, I guess what became the election special I did with Ryan Christian of TLAV. It's entitled, "Experts Knew a Pandemic Was Coming. Here's What They're Worried About Next." This was authored in May of 2020 by one of the top directors at the Aspen Institute, a think tank funded by the Rockefeller's brother fund, the Carnegie Corporation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation chiefly. And what's fascinating is that in their near-term threats, it says likely to impact the U.S. within 5 years, the top one is the globalization of white supremacy. That first paragraph reads, terrorism today conjures images of ISIS fighters and suicide bombers, but if you ask national security officials about the top near-term terrorism threat on their radar, they most universally point to the rising problem of white nationalist violence and the insidious way that groups that formerly existed locally have been knitting themselves together in a global web of white supremacism. In recent weeks, the State Department formally designated a white supremacist organization called the Russian Imperial Movement as a terrorist organization because it's trying to train and seed adherents around the globe, inspiring them to carry out terror attacks. It continues, there are serious and explicit warnings about this coming from U.S. government and foreign officials that eerily echo the warnings that came about for Al-Qaeda before 9/11. This is pretty interesting because essentially, if you have the CIA right now basically admitting that they're arming white supremacist forces and creating an insurgency in Ukraine, and they've also been essentially saying that there's this global web of white supremacy to come, I guess then you get your war on domestic terror in countries where there's a, you know, wherever they want to seed it, really. And they can just say, oh, this was a person radicalized in Ukraine, and then you have your war on domestic terror ready to go. And pretty much in the same vein as this, you had the health minister of Saxony in Germany being quoted by the New York Times as saying, you can't distinguish anyone who was on the streets because of vaccines and COVID restrictions and who was already radicalized as part of a article in the New York Times about how in Germany, security agencies see a merging, they say, of people who oppose COVID restrictions and the far right in Nazism. So it seems like there's a lot going on here, and I'm kind of concerned that we're seeing the seeding of the infrastructure, I guess you could say, for the war on domestic terror as a way to sort of quell any sort of dissent that would pop up in white majority countries in the West as this new system that we talked about in the first part of the podcast is hammered through. Do you have any thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, the irony is, I mean, everybody that opposed the COVID restrictions was cast as a far right
or Nazi, right?
Extremist. Mm-hmm.
And now they will, I think.
So, I mean, mm-hmm. you've got the crazy irony that you've got the truckers' freedom convoy who were, you know, from every background. Many were Native American, Native Canadian, Aboriginal people. That they cast them as fascists, so said they were fascists. Meanwhile, the Trudeau government was sending weapons and arms and heavy weaponry to fascists, to real fascists.
Well, Chrystia Freeland, the Minister of Finance and Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, was just participating in a pro-Ukrainian protest in Toronto after basically pulling out some insane tyrannical moves, freezing personal bank accounts of people for protesting her policies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's madness. Yeah. Well, I hope Canadians realize that they should be trying to hold their government more accountable than Russia accountable at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, You've got a situation where the UK has been engaged in something called Operation Orbital for the last four or 5 years, or 3 or 4 years, and they have been training the Ukrainian National Guard. Well, there was a statement that came out from the Ukrainian National Guard saying that that would include the Azov battalions. So this is the British training. I mean, and going back to what you said earlier, I'm certainly not suggesting that all the Ukrainian military and all the people that live in Ukraine are fascists or not neo-Nazis. They're not. What I am suggesting is that there are definitely neo-Nazi elements within the military and within their political hierarchy who have seized a disproportionate amount of power. Certainly, power that goes beyond their electoral reach. So, there's no doubt that the British, certainly, and the Americans, and lots of countries have been training Ukrainian forces, and a lot of that training will have been received by the Azov battalions, who are by and large neo-Nazis.
It just seems like a repeat of Afghanistan and Syria and some of these other conflicts, and it's been going on for a while. But what's interesting is that now there's this war on domestic terror infrastructure being set up, not just in the U.S., but the way the Biden administration set that up, it's for all the Five Eyes countries. It's information sharing. It's sort of like an Operation Condor style war on domestic terror. So it's definitely going to reach beyond the border of the US, and you have one of the main entities behind that war on domestic terror, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, openly admitting not that long ago that white supremacist groups in the US that they were concerned about were going to Ukraine and training with Azov Battalion and then coming back and stuff like that. So they already have their narrative set up to run with this, and I think unfortunately the current conflict in Ukraine is going to develop in that direction, especially with the CIA and the CFR and Hillary Clinton all signaling that. I mean, that definitely concerns me. Do you have any concluding thoughts before we wrap up here?
I don't believe. I think the thing that strikes me is that when you're trying to sift through, I've got a couple of our articles that are coming out. I'm writing a two-part kind of deep dive into the current situation of what is going on in Ukraine at the moment, and I'm looking at it very much from the historical perspective in part one, and then in part two, the current geopolitical situation. And in doing that, I've been researching both the Western media reports and documentation, and even official documents, and Russian and Chinese and other media reports and their documentation. And looking at the two, the thing that strikes me is that neither of them are trustworthy. Neither of them, in both senses, they're both biased. They're both pushing an agenda. Both East and West are pushing an agenda. And the truth almost certainly lies in the grey area in between. It's not, if we go down the line of believing everything that we are told, especially in our conflict situation, from either side, we've got no chance. We've got no chance of understanding what is actually happening. So I think it's really important that people think critically about the information that they're given and just try to rationally look at the evidence and contrast it from both perspectives, because the truth is in the middle. It's not at those extremes. And it is extreme. Both narratives are extreme.
All right, we'll have to leave it there, Ian. Thanks so much. Before we go, could you let people know how they can find your work and support you?
Please go to my website, which is in this together with hyphens between the word in dash this dash together.com. And also check out my work on UK Column. And if there is a donation, you can donate and support me, support my work on my website. crypto's welcome. And I'd just like to say thank you very much for having me, Whitney. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks to you, Ian, for coming back on for the second time. Hopefully you'll be back on again in the future as the world continues its descent into what appears to be total madness. Anyway, I would also like to thank the people who support this podcast and people who listen and share it. Of course, the more people who share this podcast, the more people listen. So I would really encourage you, if you enjoyed what you heard today, to share this widely once it becomes public, as people are probably familiar with by now. All of my podcasts are premium for just a few days, available to subscribers on Rockfin and people who subscribe through the unlimitedhangout.com website. If you choose to support Unlimited Hangout, of course, you will also be supporting not just my work, but those of other Unlimited Hangout contributors like Ian. So anyway, thanks so much, everyone, and catch you all in the next episode.